Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Over the last few months, China has simultaneously been battling the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic within its borders and has also adopted a surprisingly belligerent stance in the South China Sea, the disputed territory that is disputed by a number of East Asian countries. To help understand what exactly is motivating China's belligerence along its maritime borders, I have with me Suyash Desai and Manoj Kewalramani. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey,
Suyash and Manoj have worked on a slide doc that details the PRC's motivations and provides a bit of background on what exactly it's doing. But this podcast will also help you get a little bit of context on that. And as always, you'll find a link to our research in the description. So over to you guys. Let's first start by trying to set out the context of disputes in the South China Sea. Why exactly is there a dispute in the South China Sea in the first place? What are the various countries that are involved? And what has really been the overall situation leading up to the outbreak of the pandemic earlier this year?
So South China Sea could be called as a tinderbox in the East and Southeast Asian region. To give a bit of context to what is happening there, there have been multiple claims in that region. This region is there are claims of 7 to 8 countries. This region is important because it is a vital sea route. One third of the global trade passes through this sea route. Also, it is said and it is believed that it is one of the important areas for resources, mineral resources, and some of the peripheral countries in this region are dependent on this sea for their fishing resources, which is their staple food. So due to all this, these are the basic reasons due to which South China Sea is very important for these 6 or 7 claimants in the area, region. Why it is important for China? Because obviously China is the biggest country over there. Almost 80 to 85% of China's oil import passes through this region. 40% of its total trade regularly transits through South China Sea. This is the trade and energy part. It is also militarily important because if you observe China's geography East China Sea or Yellow Sea, the basis there is not enough shallow water for its submarine to dock. And if it has to go out into the Pacific Ocean, then it has to pass through the first chain of command and also probably the second chain of island commands. So for that, South China Sea provides enough avenues for deep waters for its submarine to dock. So that's why it is militarily also important to South China Sea. And it is also a part, if we understand Chinese foreign policy, there are certain regions which are very, colloquially, very touchy to China. So South China Sea, like Taiwan, like Tibet, like Xinjiang, South China Sea has over the years become an important part of its nationalistic discourse. So there is also a political legitimacy involved, political significance involved for China regarding the importance of South China Sea.
So I'm assuming that this nationalist motivation is probably one of the reasons why China is being so belligerent over the last few months, right? So Manoj, can you tell us a bit about what exactly China has been up to and maybe kind of contextualize that with China's broader fight against the pandemic, both domestically and in terms of international public relations?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, the South China Sea has become far more significant from the Chinese perspective. I mean, it's always been an important sort of node from the point of view of territorial integrity. They made those claims reasonably early after the PRC was established. But then, the idea that they drew these 9 dashes in the South China Sea, saying that this is our territory, was always problematic. And there's lots of historical dispute over whether this was at all anybody's territory in that sense. And also the fact that all these features that people are claiming in the South China Sea, whether you can claim them as territory and so on and so forth. From the point of view of what they've been doing in the recent past, I would sort of like to go back to about a little bit over a decade ago, sort of in 2008, 2009 onwards, you start to see the Chinese get far more aggressive in this part of the world. They sort of start to, there are incidents with other countries, so the Philippines, Vietnam, along these islands and these shoals in South China Sea. There are clashes, there are sort of accidents with the ships. There is exchange of fire also. And subsequently, the Chinese start to build these artificial islands in the South China Sea. And those islands are eventually then militarized. There's a point of time when Xi Jinping met Barack Obama, I think this was in 2014, if I'm correct, and he committed that, China, yes, we built some of these islands, but we're not going to be militarizing them. And then he, you know, bloody well went ahead and did it. And so they've sort of consolidated control over this region. Now, as the sort of pandemic hit, what we've observed, and this is sort of public data, is that there's been an intensification in terms of the number of incidents with other claimants. And this sort of starts before the pandemic. So it's not necessarily directly starting in late January as the pandemic hit, but it sort of starts from late December. In December, there is an incident sort of clashes with, the Indonesians in the Natuna Sea. Then you sort of see more drills in and around Taiwan, more Air Force drills and Navy drills. And these are also part of sort of, you know, yes, Taiwan was going through an election in January, early January. So some of these drills are about creating pressure. But as the sort of pandemic hit China first, a lot of this stuff stopped. And then from late February and then subsequently from late March onward, you see a massive uptick in activity. There's a collision with a Japanese destroyer in the East China Sea. There's this survey vessel, the Yangtze, which goes in through Vietnam's exclusive economic zone and then sort of sails from there to enter Malaysia's. The PRC sort of reiterates its sovereignty over the Spratlys and the Paracel Islands. It establishes something called the Shisha and Nansha districts, which are administrative districts, supposedly administering or sort of providing governance on these islands. And it renames 80 features within the South China Sea. So these are all sort of steps in escalation in terms of stating its claim of sovereignty far more emphatically. Now, part of this, you can look at it as from a domestic political perspective, the more pressure Xi Jinping and his administration was under through February, March, and April of its handling of the outbreak of COVID-19, the more it probably required to stoke nationalism so that, you know, you divert public attention, you create this sense of siege mentality where the West is sort of targeting us and there is this illness that's come through and all of that. And you sort of stoke the fact that, look, we've done such a great job in tackling COVID, and compare that gradually to the West, wherein America has obviously not done a great job at all. So some of these things sort of play a role in how they start to leverage these claims. And also the fact that, look, you've got an opportunity, right? The world is busy with the pandemic. So you've also got an opportunity to sort of do things, or at least try to do things that you probably were not doing in the past. So that's some of the ways in which this can be looked at, particularly in terms of the nationalistic narrative thing. That's the idea, right? You start to, as you start to feel pressure on a certain area of core governance, whether it's public health, economy, and so on and so forth, you can always rake up these bogeys and they become far more important in public discourse.
There's quite a few things that stand out to me here. I mean, the first, of course, is the fact that China seems to have turned this quote-unquote cartographic escalation into a fine art at this point. They do a very good job of kind of making claims by publishing different kinds of maps. And this renaming, creating administrative districts in the South China Sea is something that I find quite striking, because who are they administering aside from PLA personnel who are on these militarized islands, right? And it's also kind of interesting to me. So in 2017, like when the Doklam crisis happened between India and China, and basically the entire international media, correctly or incorrectly, went gaga over India standing up to China, at least in the earlier weeks of the escalation. And almost as a response to that, Chinese state media immediately went hammer and tongs on the nationalist narrative, you know, trying to seeming to kind of reinforce this idea that, yes, the CCP is going to take care of China's borders and so on. So it's kind of interesting to see that narrative kind of coming back up again, just as China is facing a little bit of just as the CCP is facing a little bit of domestic pressure, I understand, because of its handling of the pandemic. In terms of the kind of things that it's actually been doing, Manoj, like, for example, you talked about how it's been destroyers have been going out colliding with the destroyers of other countries. You talked about the fact that it's really like kind of finalized that its administrative control over various parts of the South China Sea. It renamed a lot of features. How in keeping are they with what China generally does in the region? And secondly, given that, sure, a lot of these countries are, of course, tackling the COVID-19 pandemic, but the US also seems to be adopting a somewhat more confrontational stance with China now than it normally has. So do you see any potential for escalation happening as a result of all these activities?
Yeah, I mean, we've tried to, in the document that we'll sort of share, we've tried to create a matrix where we try to assess what could be sort of causes for escalation further. And we'll get to that right in this conversation. But and I want to take us back to a point that you'd raised, which is about, and this was a matter of sort of some debate amongst us while we were working on this document, about whether what we are seeing currently in the South China Sea, or what we saw in April, May, late March to sort of May, which is the period that we've documented, whether that was excessive, something that was markedly different, or whether that was sort of continuation of what China has been doing, and therefore sort of not surprising. But it felt far more jarring because you were in a situation where the world faces, you know, an unprecedented crisis. In that environment, to be doing some of these things felt to observers far more opportunistic. So we ourselves sort of had this discussion amongst ourselves, and there were differences of opinion in terms of how we saw it also, and therefore when we sort of documented the motivations that we believe that the CCP has in sort of dealing with this, we came up with a bunch of different motivations, and we sort of examined each of these different ideas. So we looked at whether this is opportunistic escalation, whether this is, you know, just plain outright coercion, because now you've got the moment that you can sort of create a fait accompli for these smaller regional states, smaller regional powers, amid a time when the US is, being far more aggressive in terms of its approach to China, but is also quite busy. So it might not want to necessarily escalate militarily, or might not have the capacity right now to immediately sort of escalate, but that's sort of debatable. The US has significant capacity. The next part, we looked at sort of, you know, whether this is driven by a sense of insecurity. The Chinese might themselves be feeling quite insecure, given that COVID-19 has created so many, sort of opened so many challenges for them. And also there is a challenge in Taiwan, there's a new challenge in Hong Kong. So maybe this is about showing strength to deter somebody from taking action. It could, like we said, be about domestic propaganda. It could be about being offensive defense, you know, which is where, you know, just trying to show that the fact that your mishandling of the earlier sort of mishandling of COVID-19 created certain issues, but now you're on this offensive to divert the issue and to protect your periphery. Or it could be individual sort of country-specific issues, like, you know, tensions with Vietnam could be local in terms of the issues with Vietnam, and so on and so forth. So we looked at it through a prism and to try and see what exactly we believe is actually happening. Of course, there's no way to clearly know what the intention of the Chinese leadership is. But based on what we sort of observed, we came to the conclusion that, look, this escalation is likely going to be very useful from a domestic propaganda perspective. It's going to whip up nationalism, and that's going to be helpful. Beijing is probably bargaining that the US is not going to escalate any further. But there will be sort of limits to what China can do, because further escalation will also be damaging for it. And what's going to happen in the long term is that as you sort of look at this narrow objective of trying to push your claims during an opportunity or to try and appease domestic concerns, you will end up creating a counterproductive environment for you in the long term, because states in the region which, if the US is going to take a far more hostile position with regard to China, then there's these smaller claimants in the region, these smaller powers in the region, will now see that if they don't balance with the US, then they might end up facing a fait accompli with China. So they might actually actually seek to balance with the US. So that's the kind of challenge. And also things like, you know, the Chinese were pushing this South China Sea code of conduct conversation, where you create a structure whereby which these claimants can operate within the South China Sea. Those kinds of conversations will just vanish, because if Beijing becomes belligerent, the others will not want to talk. And we've seen sort of gradually that happening with the Indonesians sort of being far more assertive also. So I think that's how we've approached this particular issue in terms of the broader thing. But Suyash, if you want to add.
As Manoj has already mentioned, so these are some opportunistic things that the China is doing, that the People's Republic of China is doing amid the crisis. As we have figured out in the document, the escalation increased in the second and third week of March to 2020. This was the time when China was able to at least create a narrative that it has controlled the outbreak, and US was suffering due to the graph of the outbreak was going up in case of United States. All its forward bases in the Pacific Ocean were impacted. The vessels that are usually deployed in the Pacific Ocean, US's vessels were also impacted due to the corona outbreak. Thus, as Manoj has already discussed and we have figured out in this document, China could sense an opportunity to assert its sovereignty over this disputed areas in the Pacific Ocean. And this opportunity was created by a limited withdrawal of the United States from this region for time being. There are different ways in which sovereignty is asserted. For example, it created military districts in the South China Sea. Now they are cultivating vegetation on few of the artificially created islands in the South China Sea. It is important to note why they are doing this. The 2016 tribunal, PCA that gave verdict in favor of the Philippines and said that any artificial island, China is not able to claim all this territory just because of their artificial construction. An important point in that judgment was that any structure to claim EEZ should be above a significant level of sea. So above a significant sea level, one. And point number two, the structure should have permanent vegetation and permanent habitation. Otherwise, the structure is not entitled to claim the nearby EEZ area. So these are the things that China is doing right now. For example, creating vegetation, which would ultimately lead to developing permanent habitation over there, not military habitation, which would help it to legally claim EEZ in the future. So these are some things China is using advantage of this pandemic to assert its sovereignty over this region. Also, another important point, as Manoj has already mentioned, this document traces the show of strength or offensive defense. China is doing certain things so that others or the regional actors or the extra-regional actors shouldn't do certain things in this region. For example, they shouldn't take aggressive portions. So China is taking the aggressive approach at the first place to deter regional and extra-regional actors to be aggressive in this region. This is how, by showing strength. So this can be one of the motivations for the People's Republic of China to do such things in the South China Sea.
So let me try to contextualize this within China's other kind of foreign relations, right? So I've looked in recent times more at the Sino-Indian border. And it seems like this fait accompli tactic that you guys are describing seems to be a pretty well-established way of doing things for China, wherein it basically like moves into a disputed area. It kind of entrenches itself and it moves up like it moves up support units and a support infrastructure, which other countries which aren't as militarily capable find difficult to react to very often, right? But in the South China Sea, because of the presence of the US, I mean, the US is sitting right there in Okinawa, based just south of Japan, potentially ready to swoop in at any point of time. Is there really a higher potential for escalation? What kind of form might this escalation take? Manoj, you mentioned that you've seen in previous cases, how other countries like Indonesia, for example, have begun to bandwagon with the US because of this kind of Chinese tactic of doing fait accompli. Given that right now the world is facing a global pandemic, the US especially is still struggling to contain the pandemic, and it's also facing its own kind of race riots and riots against police brutality right now. Realistically speaking, what form might this escalation take? Realistically speaking, in the long term, how do you see this kind of bandwagoning against Chinese aggression playing out?
So if you go back a couple of years, what you would have seen is that, you know, this talk of a Sino-US Cold War has been going on for a few years, at least now. In that, if you go back to sort of every year, you have the Shangri-La dialogues in Singapore. And if you hear the Singaporeans and others speak over there, basically they're saying that we don't want to choose sides. And that would be the preferred goal of these other countries, that you don't want to choose sides, or you want to sort of hedge and make the best out of the competition between these two great powers. That makes sense even from an Indian perspective. We wouldn't want to choose sides, but push comes to shove, we might have to choose sides. But ideally, we wouldn't want to choose sides, and we can hedge and, you know, be in different, instead of being in camps, be in tents on issues and things like that. That's the same sort of argument that even sort of other Southeast Asian countries are making, because choosing sides and being in camps opens you up to great risk. I think that's what they will want to continue to do. I think their only concern would be with regard to what's happening in the US and the reliability of the US as a partner. That will make any choosing sides even more tricky, because, you know, if the US is not going to be a reliable partner, and if the US president is going to just make up conversations like he made up with the Indian prime minister recently, it's going to be really challenging for these guys to choose sides. That said, the US has overwhelming capacity. And if it gets its, you know, leadership and diplomacy together, there's lots that the US can achieve. That said, that putting that aside, I mean, if we looked at it from the point of view of, look, if the PRC is displaying this increasing risk appetite all along its maritime periphery, then there could be certain steps that it could be take, that it could take. There could be certain measures that it could take, which could lead to an escalation. These could be miscalculations, these could be accidents, these could be misperceptions, or these could be deliberate attempts. We then sort of classified these into six different scenarios of escalation. So I'm just going to sort of quickly rattle out these six scenarios. So a limited blocking action, this could mean sort of you know, harass merchant vessels or fishing vessels, disrupt drilling activities. Now, this sort of stuff happens and happens reasonably regularly. So our assessment was that, look, the risk of this escalating into conflict is not very high. It'll lead to localized tensions, yes, but it might not necessarily lead to conflict, or at least the risk of it is very, very low. Declaration of the ADIZ, which Suyash talked about, that to me would be a significantly escalatory step taken by the Chinese if they do take it. The talk of this ADIZ has been around for years, ever since the East China Sea ADIZ was declared by the Chinese, which was under Xi Jinping, very early into his tenure as the president. This has been the talk of many, many years. They haven't done it as yet. Could they do it now? Yes. But the moment they do it, just like the US has challenged the East China Sea ADIZ, the US will challenge the South China Sea ADIZ. And I'm sure it'll also throw into sort of a complete scramble all talks between East Asian countries and China, because nobody will accept an East China, a South China Sea ADIZ, because that effectively means that you're saying that, it doesn't effectively mean that it's my territory, but it means that I actually control in-flight movement and so on and so forth, and I need to be informed about those things when you're flying in or when you're sailing through. And countries will not do that. That could lead to another threat, which is collisions and accidents. Again, there have been collisions in the past. There have been accidents in the past. There have been even things where planes have been down. In 2001, if you go back to the EP3 incident between the US and China, both countries have managed to, in the past, step down from those sort of dangerous ladders. But given today's environment, it would be very, very difficult if an American plane, a spy plane or something like that, a drone was to go down, or even a jet. And there have been cases, there have been the last few years of moments where, you know, jets have come too close to each other. There have been dangerous maneuvers in sea and so forth. These are, so again, a very high risk thing that could lead to an accident, that could lead to something severe. We looked at non-lethal attacks in which you're sort of doing electronic jamming, GPS spoofing, so on and so forth. or you're doing drills and these kinds of things, violations of airspace, these kinds of things. Again, these happen on a routine basis, and the threat of these becoming conflict is very, very low. But these could be sort of the first steps that lead to greater changes. Again, at the highest level, you've got obviously a forceful change in status quo. Now, the Chinese have done a lot of changes in status quo through its salami slicing tactic that you also referred to earlier. But if you now go ahead and take over certain pockets, which are, say, occupied by other players, or if you sort of do something forceful, not just in the South China Sea, but even maybe in the East China Sea with the Senkakus, to me, any sort of forceful change in status quo will, in all likelihood, lead to conflict. Because it is going to be extremely difficult for any country to sort of absorb that sort of a change. So the conflict risk on that is extremely high, even higher than, say, the declaration of an ADIZ. And finally, we looked at sort of sabotage, intelligence operations, and so on and so forth, where you sort of maybe undermine critical infrastructure in Vietnam or in Taiwan, or you sort of target undersea cables in order to coerce states. Again, as we sort of classified this at amber level in our graded meter, we have a green, yellow, amber, red, and we classified it in amber level, sort of early amber, because these can create problems, but might not necessarily lead to conflict. So that's how we looked at the potential threat of escalation.
All right. So in summation, you guys have talked about the importance of South China Sea to the People's Republic. You've talked about the various motivations that might be driving what they're doing there, and the potential for escalation of various things that China could potentially do. So before we wrap up this conversation, guys, final words, what is your prognosis in terms of what do you see China doing next, given the current international situation, its current domestic political compulsions? Do you see other countries that are party to the South China Sea dispute doing anything right now, or does it already depend on what China does in the months to come?
In case of escalatory scenarios, as our document points out, and as already mentioned by Manoj, there are few things which are highly escalatory. So South China Sea is like a tinderbox which is about to explode, and we argue that if these few things happen, then it could lead to higher escalation in this region. These things are creating declaration of ADIZ. China has already declared ADIZ in East China Sea. Now, if there is only one ADIZ in the South China Sea, and that is Philippines ADIZ. If China declares ADIZ in South China Sea, then it can lead to, it could have a high escalatory outcome. Similarly, collisions or accidents, especially between the US and the Chinese Navy, could lead to greater escalation. And if, of course, there is a change of status quo. For example, there is in East China Sea or in South China Sea, for example, there are a lot of claims happening, or there are a lot of speculations that China is going for a Taiwanese island. So if such sort of things happen in the South China Sea, then it could have a greater escalatory things going ahead, greater escalatory probability going ahead. So these are the few things that we have identified could lead to escalation in the South China Sea. And I believe that the onus of the escalation is squarely on the People's Republic of China. This is because all other actors except the United States of America are not capable to create an escalation. Their approach to this region is generally reactive to what the People's Republic of China does. So the onus of escalation of this dispute squarely falls on China. So escalation will only happen if there is an escalatory step, as mentioned in our document, by China, which would lead to other actors reacting to this. So these are the few things that we have outlined in the document.
Yeah, I also believe that the onus of escalation would be on China. But I mean, I want to sort of there are limits to what you will see and you can see from the US. I mean, if you just go back to, I think it was last year in a congressional testimony. No, in 2018, you had the US Indo-Pacific Command Chief, Admiral Philip Davidson, saying that, look, the Chinese have effectively established sea control and sea denial in the South China Sea. And it's going to be extremely difficult for the US to sort of compete with them. That doesn't mean that they can't. It just means that the cost of that competition is going to be extremely high. So from an American perspective, because at the end of the day, like Suresh said, it's the US is going to have to push back. These countries can band together, they can push, but it's going to be very difficult, particularly when you're clubbed as ASEAN. In that grouping also, you've got other countries which may be far more favorably disposed to China than others. So there are divisions within ASEAN. So the US will have to play a big role. But in that case, would it want to bear those costs? And that would be the big question, because if the costs are very, very high, it might not want to bear those costs. That said, South China Sea is very, very important for trade. Would the declaration of an ADIZ mean significant change? And if the Chinese can't impose the kind of control that one needs to on an ADIZ, would the US want to escalate? Because if it can really violate that ADIZ, why would it want to escalate into conflict? So there are some of these things that we need to keep in mind. But yeah, I mean, I agree largely that the onus of escalation would lie on China. The US has continued with its freedom of navigation operations. Even this week, there was one. So that's going to continue. So that push and pull is going to continue. But any sort of escalation would be if the Chinese sort of do something different now.
Interesting. All right. So thank you guys so much for joining me. Please check out Manoj and Suyash's paper. You'll find a link to it in our description. And keep listening to All Things Policy for more updates on what's happening in the world's most interesting pond. Thank you so much for joining us.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.